Stay. Now tell me.
She set her hand upon her stick, in the resolute way that sometimes was habitual to her, and looked at the fire with a strong expression of forcing herself to attend. I went on with my explanation, and told her how I had hoped to complete the transaction out of my means, but how in this I was disappointed. That part of the subject, I reminded her, involved matters which could form no part of my explanation, for they were the weighty secrets of another.
"So," said she, assenting with her head but not looking at me, "and how much money is wanting to complete the purchase?"
I was rather afraid of stating it, for it sounded a large sum.
£900. "If I give you the money for this purpose, will you keep my secret as you have kept your own?"
"Quite as faithfully."
"And your mind will be more at rest?"
"Much more at rest."
"Are you very unhappy now?"
She asked this question, still without looking at me, but in an unwanted tone of sympathy. I could not reply at the moment, for my voice failed me. She put her left arm across the head of her stick, and softly laid her forehead on it. "I am far from happy, Miss Havisham, but I have other causes of disquiet than any you know of. They are the secrets I have mentioned." After a little while, she raised her head and looked at the fire again.
"'Tis noble in you to tell me that you have other causes of unhappiness. Is it true?"
"Too true."
"Can I only serve you, Pip, by serving your friend? Regarding that as done, is there nothing I can do for you, yourself?"
"Nothing. I thank you for the question. I thank you even more for the tone of the question, but there is nothing." She presently rose from her seat and looked about the blighted room for the means of writing. There were none there, and she took from her pocket a yellow set of ivory tablets, mounted in tarnished gold, and wrote upon them with a pencil, in a case of tarnished gold that hung from her neck.
"You are still on friendly terms with Mr. Jaggers?"
"Quite. I dined with him yesterday."
"This is an authority to him to pay you that money, to lay out at your irresponsible discretion for your friend. I keep no money here, but if you would rather Mr. Jaggers knew nothing of the matter, I will send it to you."
"Thank you, Miss Havisham. I have not the least objection to receiving it from him." She read me what she had written, and it was direct and clear, and evidently intended to absolve me from any suspicion of profiting by the receipt of the money. I took the tablets from her hand, and it trembled again, and it trembled more as she took off the chain to which the pencil was attached, and put it in mine. All this she did without looking at me.
"My name is on the first leaf. If you can ever write under my name, I forgive her, though ever so long after my broken heart is dust. Pray do it."
"Oh, Miss Havisham," said I can do it now. There have been sore mistakes, and my life has been a blind and thankless one, and I want forgiveness and direction far too much to be bitter with you." She turned her face to me for the first time since she had averted it, and to my amazement, I may even add to my terror, dropped on her knees at my feet, with her folded hands raised to me in the manner in which, when her poor heart was young and fresh and whole, they must often have been raised to heaven from her mother's side. To see her, with her white hair and her worn face, kneeling at my feet, gave me a shock through all my frame. I entreated her to rise, and got my arms about her to help her up, but she only pressed that hand of mine which was nearest to her grasp, and hung her head over it and wept. I had never seen her shed a tear before, and in the hope that the relief might do her good, I bent over her without speaking. She was not kneeling now, but was down upon the ground.
"Oh," she cried despairingly, "what have I done? What have I done?"
"If you mean, Miss Havisham, what have you done to injure me? Let me answer, very little. I should have loved her under any circumstances. Is she married?
Yes.
It was a needless question, for a new desolation in the desolate house had told me so.
What have I done? What have I done?
She wrung her hands and crushed her white hair, and returned to this cry over and over again.
What have I done?
I knew not how to answer, or how to comfort her. That she had done a grievous thing in taking an impressionable child to mould into the form that her wild resentment, spurned affection, and wounded pride found vengeance in, I knew full well. But that in shutting out the light of day, she had shut out infinitely more. That in seclusion she had secluded herself from a thousand natural and healing influences. That her mind, brooding solitary, had grown diseased as all minds do, and must and will, that reverse the appointed order of their Maker, I knew equally well. And could I look upon her without compassion, seeing her punishment in the ruin she was, in her profound unfitness for this earth on which she was placed, in the vanity of sorrow, which had become a master mania, like the vanity of penitence, the vanity of remorse, the vanity of unworthiness, and other monstrous vanities that have been curses in this world.
Until you spoke to her the other day, and until I saw in you a looking-glass that showed me what I once felt myself, I did not know what I had done. What have I done? What have I done?
And so again, 20, 50 times over, what had she done? Miss Havisham, I said when her cry had died away, you may dismiss me from your mind and conscience, but Estella is a different case, and if you can ever undo any scrap of what you have done amiss in keeping a part of her right nature away from her, it will be better to do that than to bemoan the past through 100 years.
Yes, yes, I know it, but, Pip, my dear.
There was an earnest womanly compassion for me in her new affection.
My dear, believe this. When she first came to me, I meant to save her from misery like my own. At first I meant no more.
Well, well, said I hope so.
But as she grew and promised to be very beautiful, I gradually did worse, and with my praises and with my jewels and with my teachings and with this figure of myself always before her, a warning to back and point my lessons, I stole her heart away and put ice in its place.
Better, I could not help saying, to have left her a natural heart, even to be bruised or broken. With that, Miss Havisham looked distractedly at me for a while, and then burst out again. What had she done?
If you knew all my story, she pleaded, you would have some compassion for me and a better understanding of me.
Miss Havisham, I answered as delicately as I could, I believe I may say that I do know your story, and have known it ever since I first left this neighbourhood. It has inspired me with great commiseration, and I hope I understand it and its influences. Does what has passed between us give me any excuse for asking you a question relative to Estella? Not as she is, but as she was when first she came here. She was seated on the ground, with her arms on the ragged chair, and her head leaning on them. She looked full at me when I said this, and replied, "Go on." "Whose child was Estella?" She shook her head. "You don't know." She shook her head again. "But Mr. Jaggers brought her here, or sent her here."
"Brought her here."
"Will you tell me how that came about?" She answered in a low whisper and with caution.
"I had been shut up in these rooms a long time. I don't know how long. You know what time the clocks keep here. When I told him that I wanted a little girl to rear and love and save from my fate, I had first seen him when I sent for him to lay this place waste for me, having read of him in the newspapers before I and the world parted. He told me that he would look about him for such an orphan child. One night, he brought her here asleep, and I called her Estella.
Might I ask her age, then?
2 or 3? She herself knows nothing, but that she was left an orphan, and I adopted her.
So convinced I was of that woman's being her mother, that I wanted no evidence to establish the fact in my mind. But to any mind, I thought, the connection here was clear and straight. What more could I hope to do by prolonging the interview? I had succeeded on behalf of Herbert. Miss Havisham had told me all she knew of Estella. I had said and done what I could to ease her mind. No matter with what other words we parted. We parted. Twilight was closing in when I went downstairs into the natural air. I called to the woman who had just opened the gate when I entered that I would not trouble her just yet, but would walk round the place before leaving, for I had a presentiment that I should never be there again, and I felt that the dying light was suited to my last view of it. By the wilderness of casks that I had walked on long ago, and on which the rain of years had fallen since, rotting them in many places, leaving miniature swamps and pools of water upon those that stood on end, I made my way to the ruined garden. I went all round it, round by the corner where Herbert and I had fought our battle, round by the paths where Estella and I had walked, so cold, so lonely, so dreary all. Taking the brewery on my way back, I raised the rusty latch of a little door at the garden end of it, and walked through. I was going out at the opposite door, not easy to open now, for the damp wood had started and swelled, and the hinges were yielding, and the threshold was encumbered with a growth of fungus. When I turned my head to look back, a childish association revived with wonderful force in the moment of the slight action, and I fancied that I saw Miss Havisham hanging to the beam. So strong was the impression that I stood under the beam shuddering from head to foot before I knew it was a fancy, though to be sure I was there in an instant. The mournfulness of the place and time, and the great terror of this illusion, though it was but momentary, caused me to feel an indescribable awe as I came out between the open wooden gates where I had once wrung my hair after Estella had wrung my heart. Passing on into the front courtyard, I hesitated whether to call the woman to let me out at the locked gate of which she had the key, or first to go upstairs and assure myself that Miss Havisham was as safe and well as I had left her. I took the latter course and went in. I looked into the room where I had left her, and I saw her seated in the ragged chair upon the hearth close to the fire, with her back towards me. In the moment when I was withdrawing my head to go quietly away, I saw a great flaming light spring up. In the same moment I saw her running at me, shrieking, with a whirl of fire blazing all about her and soaring at least as many feet above her head as she was high. I had a double-caped greatcoat on, and over my arm another thick coat. That I got them off, closed with her, threw her down and got them over her. That I dragged the great cloth from the table for the same purpose, and with it dragged down the heap of rottenness in the midst and all the ugly things that sheltered there. That we were on the ground struggling like desperate enemies, and that the closer I covered her, the more wildly she shrieked and tried to free herself. That this occurred I knew through the result, but not through anything I felt or thought or knew I did. I knew nothing until I knew that we were on the floor by the great table, and the patches of tinder yet alight were floating in the smoky air which a moment ago had been her faded bridal dress. Then I looked round and saw the disturbed beetles and spiders running away over the floor, and the servants coming in with breathless cries at the door. I still held her forcibly down with all my strength, like a prisoner who might escape, and I doubt if I even knew who she was or why we had struggled, or that she had been in flames, or that the flames were out, until I saw the patches of tinder that had been her garments, no longer alight, but falling in a black shower around us. She was insensible, and I was afraid to have her moved, or even touched. Assistance was sent for, and I held her until it came, as if I unreasonably fancied, I think I did, that if I let her go, the fire would break out again and consume her. When I got up, on the surgeons coming to her with other aid, I was astonished to see that both my hands were burnt, for I had no knowledge of it through the sense of feeling. On examination, it was pronounced that she had received serious hurts, but that they of themselves were far from hopeless. The danger lay mainly in the nervous shock. By the surgeon's directions, her bed was carried into that room and laid upon the great table, which happened to be well suited to the dressing of her injuries. When I saw her again, an hour afterwards, she lay indeed where I had seen her strike her stick, and had heard her say she would lie one day. Though every vestige of her dress was burnt, as they told me, she still had something of her old ghastly bridal appearance, for they had covered her to the throat with white cotton wool, and as she lay with a white sheet loosely overlying that, the phantom air of something that had been and was changed was still upon her. I found, on questioning the servants, that Estella was in Paris, and I got a promise from the surgeon that he would write by the next post. Miss Havisham's family I took upon myself, intending to communicate with Mr. Matthew Pocket only, and leave him to do as he liked about informing the rest. This I did next day through Herbert, as soon as I returned to town. There was a stage that evening when she spoke collectedly of what had happened, though with a certain terrible vivacity. Towards midnight, she began to wander in her speech, and after that it gradually set in that she said innumerable times, in a low, solemn voice, "What have I done?" And then, "When she first came, I meant to save her from misery like mine." And then, "Take the pencil and write under my name, 'I forgive her.'" She never changed the order of those three sentences, but she sometimes left out a word in one or other of them, never putting in another word, but always leaving a blank and going on to the next word. As I could do no service there, and as I had, nearer home, that pressing reason for anxiety and fear which even her wanderings could not drive out of my mind, I decided in the course of the night that I would return by the early morning coach, walking on a mile or so, and being taken up clear of the town. At about 6 o'clock of the morning, therefore, I leaned over her and touched her lips with mine, just as they said, not stopping for being touched, "Take the pencil and write under my name, 'I forgive her.'" Chapter 50. My hands had been dressed twice or thrice in the night, and again in the morning. My left arm was a good deal burned to the elbow, and less severely as high as the shoulder. It was very painful, but the flames had set in that direction, and I felt thankful it was no worse. My right hand was not so badly burnt, but that I could move the fingers. It was bandaged, of course, but much less inconveniently than my left-handed arm. Those I carried in a sling, and I could only wear my coat like a cloak, loose over my shoulders and fastened at the neck. My hair had been caught by the fire, but not my head or face. When Herbert had been down to Hammersmith and had seen his father, he came back to me at our chambers and devoted the day to attending on me. He was the kindest of nurses, and at stated times took off the bandages and steeped them in the cooling liquid that was kept ready, and put them on again with a patient tenderness that I was deeply grateful for. At first, as I lay quiet on the sofa, I found it painfully difficult, I might say impossible, to get rid of the impression of the glare of the flames, their hurry and noise, and the fierce burning smell. If I dozed for a minute, I was awakened by Miss Havisham's cries, and by her running at me with all that height of fire above her head. This pain of the mind was much harder to strive against than any bodily pain I suffered, and Herbert, seeing that, did his utmost to hold my attention engaged. Neither of us spoke of the boat, but we both thought of it. That was made apparent by our avoidance of the subject, and by our agreeing, without agreement, to make my recovery of the use of my hands a question of so many hours, not of so many weeks. My first question when I saw Herbert had been, of course, whether all was well down the river. As he replied in the affirmative, with perfect confidence and cheerfulness, we did not resume the subject until the day was wearing away. But then, as Herbert changed the bandages, more by the light of the fire than by the outer light, he went back to it spontaneously. "I sat with Provis last night, Handel. 2 good hours. Where was Clara?"
"Dear little thing," said Herbert.
"She was up and down with Gruff and Grim all the evening. He was perpetually pegging at the floor, the moment she left his sight. I doubt if he can hold out long, though. What with rum and pepper and pepper and rum, I should think his pegging must be nearly over."
"And then you will be married, Herbert?"
"How can I take care of the dear child otherwise? Lay your arm out upon the back of the sofa, my dear boy, and I'll sit down here and get the bandage off so gradually that you shall not know when it comes. I was speaking of Provis. Do you know, Handel, he improves?"
"I said to you I thought he was softened when I saw him last."
"So you did, and so he is. He was very communicative last night, and told me more of his life. You remember his breaking off here about some woman that he'd had great trouble with? Did I hurt you?"
I had started, but not under his touch. His words had given me a start.
"I'd forgotten that, Herbert, but I remember it now you speak of it. Well, he went into that part of his life, and a dark, wild part it is. Shall I tell you, or would it worry you just now?"
"Tell me by all means, every word."
Herbert bent forward to look at me more nearly, as if my reply had been rather more hurried or more eager than he could quite account for.
"Your head is cool?" he said, touching it.
"Quite," said I. "Tell me what Provis said, my dear Herbert."
"It seems," said Herbert. "There's a bandage off most charmingly. Now comes the cool one. Makes you shrink at first, my poor dear fellow, don't it? But it will be comfortable presently. It seems that the woman was a young woman, and a jealous woman, and a revengeful woman. Revengeful handled to the last degree."
"To what last degree?"
"Murder. Does it strike too cold on that sensitive place?"
"I don't feel it. How did she murder? Whom did she murder?"
"Why, the deed may not have merited quite so terrible a name," said Herbert. "But she was tried for it, and Mr. Jaggers defended her, and the reputation of that defence first made his name known to Provis. It was another and a stronger woman who was the victim, and there had been a struggle, in a barn. Who began it, or how fair it was, or how unfair, may be doubtful. But how it ended is certainly not doubtful, for the victim was found throttled."
"Was the woman brought in guilty?"
"No. She was acquitted. Oh, my poor Handel, I hurt you.
It's impossible to be gentler, Herbert."
"Yes, what else?"
"This acquitted young woman and Provis had a little child of whom Provis was exceedingly fond. On the evening of the very night when the object of her jealousy was strangled, as I tell you, the young woman presented herself before Provis for one moment and swore that she would destroy the child, which was in her possession, and he should never see it again. Then she vanished."
"There's the worst arm, comfortably in the sling once more. And now there remains but the right hand, which is a far easier job. I can do it better by this light than by a stronger, for my hand is steadiest when I don't see the poor blistered patches too distinctly. You don't think your breathing is affected, my dear boy? You seem to breathe quickly."
"Perhaps I do, Herbert. Did the woman keep her oath?"
"Well, there comes the darkest part of Provis's life. She did."
"That is, he says she did."
"Why, of course, my dear boy," returned Herbert in a tone of surprise, and again bending forward to get a nearer look at me. "He says it all. I have no other information."
"No, to be sure."
"Now whether," pursued Herbert, "he had used the child's mother ill, or whether he had used the child's mother well, Provis doesn't say. But she had shared some 4 or 5 years of the wretched life he described to us at this fireside, and he seems to have felt pity for her and forbearance towards her. Therefore, fearing he should be called upon to dispose about this destroyed child, and so be the cause of her death, he hid himself, much as he grieved for the child, kept himself dark, as he says, out of the way, and out of the trial, and was only vaguely talked of as a certain man called Abel, out of whom the jealousy arose. After the acquittal, she disappeared, and thus he lost the child,
and the child's mother. I want to ask, a moment, my dear boy, and I've done. That evil genius, Compeyson, the worst of scoundrels among many scoundrels, knowing of his keeping out of the way at that time, and of his reasons for doing so, of course afterwards, held the knowledge over his head as a means of keeping him poorer and working him harder. It was clear last night that this barbed the point of Provis's animosity. I want to know, said I, and particularly Herbert, whether he told you when this happened. Particularly? Well, let me remember, then, what he said as to that. His expression was, a round score of years ago, and almost directly after I took up were Compeyson. How old were you when you came upon him in the little churchyard?
I think in my 7th year.
Aye, it had happened some 3 or 4 years then, he said, and you brought into his mind the little girl so tragically lost, who would have been about your age.
Herbert, said I after a short silence, in a hurried way, can you see me best by the light of the window or the light of the fire?
By the firelight, answered Herbert, coming close again.
Look at me.
I do look at you, my dear boy.
Touch me.
I do touch you, my dear boy. You are not afraid that I am in any fever or that my head is much disordered by the accident of last night?
No, my dear boy, said Herbert, after taking time to examine me.
You are rather excited, but you're quite yourself.
I know I'm quite myself.
And the man we have in hiding down the river
is Estella's father.
Chapter 51. What purpose I had in view when I was hot on tracing out and proving Estella's parentage, I cannot say. It will presently be seen that the question was not before me in a distinct shape, until it was put before me by a wiser head than my own. But when Herbert and I had held our momentous conversation, I was seized with a feverish conviction that I ought to hunt the matter down, that I ought not let it rest, but that I ought to see Mr. Jaggers and come at the bare truth. I really do not know whether I felt that I did this for Estella's sake, or whether I was glad to transfer to the man in whose preservation I was so much concerned some rays of the romantic interest that had so long surrounded me. Perhaps the latter possibility may be nearer to the truth. Anyway, I could scarcely be withheld from going out to Gerrard Street that night. Herbert's representations that if I did, I should probably be laid up and stricken useless when our fugitive's safety would depend upon me, alone restrained my impatience. On the understanding, again and again reiterated, that come what would, I was to go to Mr. Jaggers tomorrow, I at length submitted to keep quiet, and to have my hurts looked after, and to stay at home. Early next morning, we went out together, and at the corner of Giltspur Street by Smithfield, I left Herbert to go his way into the city, and took my way to Little Britain. There were periodical occasions when Mr. Jaggers and Mr. Wemmick went over the office accounts and checked off the vouchers, and put all things straight. On these occasions, Wemmick took his books and papers into Mr. Jaggers' room, and one of the upstairs clerks came down into the outer office. Finding such a clerk on Wemmick's post that morning, I knew what was going on. But I was not sorry to have Mr. Jaggers and Wemmick together, as Wemmick would then hear for himself that I said nothing to compromise him. My appearance with my arm bandaged and my coat loose over my shoulders favoured my object. Although I had sent Mr. Jaggers a brief account of the accident as soon as I had arrived in town, yet I had to give him all the details now, and the speciality of the occasion caused our talk to be less dry and hard, and less strictly regulated by the rules of evidence than it had been before. While I described the disaster, Mr. Jaggers stood, according to his wont, before the fire. Wemmick leaned back in his chair, staring at me, with his hands in the pockets of his trousers and his pen put horizontally into the post. The two brutal casts, always inseparable in my mind from the official proceedings, seemed to be congestively considering whether they didn't smell fire at the present moment. My narrative finished, and their questions exhausted, I then produced Miss Havisham's authority to receive the £900 for Herbert. Mr. Jagger's eyes retired a little deeper into his head when I handed him the tablets, but he presently handed them over to Wemmick with instructions to draw the check for his signature. While that was in the course of being done, I looked on at Wemmick as he wrote, and Mr. Jaggers,
poising and swaying himself on his well-polished boots, looked on at me.
"I'm sorry, Pip,"
said he, as I put the check in my pocket when he had signed it,
"that we do nothing for you."
"Miss Havisham was good enough to ask me," I returned, "whether she could do anything for me, and I told her no."
"Everybody should know his own business," said Mr. Jaggers,
and I saw Wemmick's lips form the words, "portable property."
"I should not have told her no if I had been you," said Mr. Jaggers, "but every man ought to know his own business best."
"Every man's business," said Wemmick, rather reproachfully towards me, "is portable property."
As I thought the time was now come for pursuing the theme I had at heart, I said, turning on Mr. Jaggers, "I did ask something of Miss Havisham, however, sir. I asked her to give me some information relative to her adopted daughter, and she gave me all she possessed."
"Did she?"
said Mr. Jaggers, bending forward to look at his boots, and then straightening himself.
"Ah, I don't think I should have done so if I had been Miss Havisham, but she ought to know her own business best."
"I know more of the history of Miss Havisham's adopted child than Miss Havisham does herself, sir. I know her mother." Mr. Jaggers looked at me inquiringly and repeated,
"Mother?"
"I have seen her mother within these 3 days."
"Yes," said Mr. Jaggers.
"And so have you, sir. And you have seen her still more recently."
"Yes," said Mr. Jaggers.
"Perhaps I know more of Estella's history than even you do," said I. "I know her father, too." A certain stop that Mr. Jaggers came to in his manner. He was too self-possessed to change his manner, but he could not help it being brought to an indefinably attentive stop, assured me that he did not know who her father was. This I had strongly suspected from Provis's account, as Herbert had repeated it, of his having kept himself dark, which I pierced on to the fact that he himself was not Mr. Jaggers' client until some 4 years later, and when he could have no reason for claiming his identity. But I could not be sure of this unconsciousness on Mr. Jaggers' part before, though I was quite sure of it now.
"So, you know the young lady's father, Pip," said Mr. Jaggers.
"Yes," I replied. "And his name is Provis, from New South Wales." Even Mr. Jaggers started when I said those words. It was the slightest start that could escape a man, and the most carefully repressed and the sooner checked. But he did start, though he made it a part of the action of taking out his pocket handkerchief. How Wemmick received the announcement I am unable to say, for I was afraid to look at him just then, lest Mr. Jaggers' sharpness should detect that there had been some communication unknown to him between us.
"And on what evidence, Pip?"
asked Mr. Jaggers very coolly, as he paused with his handkerchief halfway to his nose.
"Does Provis make this claim?"
"He does not make it," said I, "and has never made it, and has no knowledge or belief that his daughter is in existence." For once the powerful pocket handkerchief failed. My reply was so unexpected that Mr. Jaggers put the handkerchief back into his pocket without completing the usual performance, folded his arms, and looked with stern attention at me through an immovable face. Then I told him all I knew, and how I knew it, with the one reservation that I left him to infer that I knew from Miss Havisham what, in fact, knew from Wemmick. I was very careful indeed as to that. Nor did I look towards Wemmick until I had finished all I had to tell, and had been for some time silently meeting Mr. Jagger's look. When I did at last turn my eyes in Wemmick's direction, I found that he had unposted his pen and was intent upon the table before him.
"Ah,"
said Mr. Jaggers at last, as he moved toward the papers on the table.
"What item was it you were at, Wemmick, when Mr. Pip came in?"
But I could not submit to be thrown off in that way, and I made a passionate, almost indignant appeal to him to be more frank and manly with me. I reminded him of the false hopes into which I had lapsed, the length of time they had lasted, and the discovery I had made, and I hinted at the danger that weighed upon my spirits. I represented myself as being surely worthy of some little confidence from him in return for the confidence I had just now imparted. I said that I did not blame him, or suspect him, or mistrust him, but I wanted assurance of the truth from him. And if he asked me why I wanted it, and why I thought I had any right to it, I would tell him, little as he cared for such poor dreams, that I had loved Estella dearly and long, and that although I had lost her, and must live a bereaved life, whatever concerned her was still nearer and dearer to me than anything else in the world. And seeing that Mr. Jaggers stood quite still and silent, and apparently quite obdurate under this appeal, I turned to Wemmick and said, "Wemmick, I know you to be a man with a gentle heart. I have seen your pleasant home and your old father, and all the innocent, cheerful, playful ways with which you refresh your business life, and I entreat you to say a word for me to Mr. Jaggers, and to represent to him that, all circumstances considered, he ought to be more open with me." I have never seen two men look more oddly at one another than Mr. Jaggers and Wemmick did after this apostrophe. At first, a misgiving crossed me that Wemmick would be instantly dismissed from his employment, but it melted as I saw Mr. Jaggers relax into something like a smile, and Wemmick become bolder.
"What's all this?" said Mr. Jaggers. "You with an old father, and you with pleasant and playful ways?"
"Well," returned Wemmick, "if I don't bring him here, what does it matter?"
"Pip," said Mr. Jaggers, laying his hands upon my arm and smiling openly, "this man must be the most cunning impostor in all London."
"Not a bit of it," returned Wemmick, growing bolder and bolder. "I think you're another." Again they exchanged their former old looks, each apparently still distrustful that the other was taking him in.
"You with a pleasant home?" said Mr. Jaggers.
"Since it don't interfere with business," returned Wemmick, "let it be so. Now I look at you, sir, I shouldn't wonder if you might be planning and contriving to have a pleasant home of your own one of these days, when you're tired of all this work." Mr. Jaggers nodded his head retrospectively two or three times, and actually drew a sigh.
"Pip," said he, "we won't talk about poor dreams. You know more about such things than I, having much fresher experience of that kind. But now, about this other matter. I'll put a case to you. Mind, I admit nothing."
He waited for me to declare that I quite understood that he expressly said that he admitted nothing.
"Now, Pip," said Mr. Jaggers, "put this case. Put the case that a woman, under such circumstances as you have mentioned, held her child concealed, and was obliged to communicate the fact to her legal adviser, on his representing to her that he must know, with an eye to the latitude of his defence, how the fact stood about that child. Put the case that at the same time he held a trust to find a child for an eccentric rich lady to adopt and bring up."
"I follow you, sir."
"Put the case that he lived in an atmosphere of evil, and that all he saw of children was their being generated in great numbers for certain destruction. Put the case that he often saw children solemnly tried at a criminal bar, where they were held up to be seen. Put the case that he habitually knew of their being imprisoned, whipped, transported, neglected, cast out, qualified in all ways for the hangman, and growing up to be hanged. Put the case that pretty nigh all the children he saw in his daily business life he had reason to look upon as so much spawn to develop into the fish that were to come to his net, to be prosecuted, defended, forsworn, made orphans, bedeviled somehow."
"I follow you, sir."
"Put the case, Pip, that here was one pretty little child out of the heap who could be saved, whom the father believed dead and dared make no stir about, as to whom, over the mother, the legal adviser had this power. I know what you did, and how you did it. You came so-and-so, you did such-and-such things to divert suspicion. I have tracked you through it all, and I tell it you all. Part with the child, unless it should be necessary to produce it to clear you, and then it shall be produced. Give the child into my hands, and I will do my best to bring you off. If you are saved, your child will be saved too. If you are lost, your child is still saved. Put the case that this was done, and that the woman was cleared.
I understand you perfectly.
But that I make no admissions.
That you make no admissions. And Wemmick repeated,
no admissions. Put the case, Pip, that passion and the terror of death had a little shaken the woman's intellects, and that when she was set at liberty she was scared out of the ways of the world and went to him to be sheltered. Put the case that he took her in, and that he kept down the old, wild, violent nature whenever he saw an inkling of it breaking out by asserting his power over her in the old way. Do you comprehend the imaginary case?
Quite.
Put the case that the child grew up and was married for money, that the mother was still living, that the father was still living, that the mother and father, unknown to one another, were dwelling within so many miles, furlongs, yards, if you like, of one another, that the secret was still a secret, except that you had got wind of it. Put that last case to yourself very carefully.
I do.
I ask Wemmick to put it to himself very carefully.
And Wemmick said, I do.
For whose sake would you reveal the secret? For the father's? I think he would not be much the better for the mother. For the mother's, I think if she had done such a deed, she would be safer where she was. For the daughter's, I think it would hardly serve her to establish her parentage for the information of her husband, and to drag her back to disgrace after an escape of 20 years, pretty secure to last for life. But add the case that you had loved her, Pip, and had made her the subject of those poor dreams which have at one time or another been in the heads of more men than you think likely. And I tell you that you had better, and would much sooner, when you had thought well of it, chop off that bandage left hand of yours with your bandage right hand, and then pass the chopper on to Wemmick there to cut that off too.
I looked at Wemmick, whose face was very grave. He gravely touched his lips with his forefinger. I did the same. Mr. Jaggers did the same.
Now, Wemmick,
said the latter then, resuming his usual manner,
what item was it you were at when Mr. Pip came in?
Standing by for a little while they were at work, I observed that the odd looks they had cast at one another were repeated several times. With this difference now, that each of them seemed suspicious, not to say conscious, of having shown himself in a weak and unprofessional light to the other. For this reason, I suppose, they were now inflexible with one another, Mr. Jaggers being highly dictatorial, and Wemmick obstinately justifying himself whenever there was the smallest point in abeyance for a moment. I had never seen them on such ill terms, for generally they got on very well indeed together. But they were both happily relieved by the opportune appearance of Mike, the client with the fur cap and the habit of wiping his nose on his sleeve, whom I had seen on the very first day of my appearance within those walls. This individual, who either in his own person or in that of some member of his family seemed to be always in trouble, which in that place meant Newgate, called to announce that his eldest daughter was taken up on suspicion of shoplifting. As he imparted this melancholy circumstance to Wemmick, Mr. Jaggers, standing magisterially before the fire and taking no share in the proceedings, Mike's eye happened to twinkle with a tear.
"What are you about?" demanded Wemmick, with the utmost indignation. "What do you come snivelling here for?"
"I didn't go to do it, Mr. Wemmick."
"You did," said Wemmick. "How dare you? You're not in a fit state to come here, if you can't come here without spluttering like a bad pen. What do you mean by it?"
"A man can't help his feelings, Mr. Wemmick," pleaded Mike.
"It's what?" demanded Wemmick, quite savagely. "Say that again."
"Now look here, my man,"
said Mr. Jaggers, advancing a step and pointing to the door.
"Get out of this office. I'll have no feelings here. Get out."
"It serves you right," said Wemmick. "Get out."
So the unfortunate Mike very humbly withdrew, and Mr. Jaggers and Wemmick appeared to have re-established their good understanding and went to work again, with an air of refreshment upon them, as if they'd just had lunch. Chapter 52. From Little Britain, I went with my cheque in my pocket to Miss Skiffin's brother, the accountant, and Miss Skiffin's brother, the accountant, going straight to Clarica's and bringing Clarica to me, I had the great satisfaction of concluding that arrangement. It was the only good thing I had done, and the only completed thing I had done since I was first apprised of my great expectations. Clarica informed me on that occasion that the affairs of the house were steadily progressing, that he would now be able to establish a small branch house in the east, which was much wanted for the extension of the business, and that Herbert, in his new partnership capacity, would go out and take charge of it. I found that I must have prepared for a separation from my friend, even though my own affairs had been more settled. And now, indeed, I felt as if my last anchor were loosening its hold, and I should soon be driving with the winds and waves. But there was recompense in the joy with which Herbert would come home of a night and tell me of these changes, little imagining that he told me no news, and would sketch airy pictures of himself conducting Clara Barley to the land of the Arabian Nights, and of me going out to join them, with a caravan of camels, I believe, and of our all going up the Nile and seeing wonders. Without being sanguine as to my own part in those bright plans, I felt that Herbert's way was clearing fast, and that old Bill Barley had but to stick to his pepper and rum, and his daughter would soon be happily provided for. We had now got into the month of March. My left arm, though it presented no bad symptoms, took in the natural course so long to heal that I was still unable to get a coat on. My right arm was tolerably restored, disfigured, but fairly serviceable. On a Monday morning, when Herbert and I were at breakfast, I received the following letter from Wemmick by the post.
Walworth, burn this as soon as read. Early in the week, or say Wednesday, you might do what you know of, if you felt disposed to try it. Now burn.
When I had shown this to Herbert, and put it in the fire, but not before we had both got it by heart, we considered what to do. For, of course, my being disabled could now be no longer kept out of view.
"I have thought it over again and again," said Herbert, "and I think I know a better course than taking a Thames waterman. Take Startop, a good fellow, a skilled hand, fond of us, and enthusiastic and honourable."
I had thought of him more than once.
"But how much would you tell him, Herbert?" "It's necessary to tell him very little. Let him suppose it a mere freak, but a secret one, until the morning comes. Then let him know that there's an urgent reason for your getting Provis aboard and away. You go with him."
"No doubt."
"Where?"
It had seemed to me, in the many anxious considerations I had given the point, almost indifferent what port we made for. Hamburg, Rotterdam, Antwerp, the place signified little, so that he was out of England. Any foreign steamer that fell in our way and would take us up would do. I had always proposed to myself to get him well down the river in the boat, certainly well beyond Gravesend, which was a critical place for search or inquiry if suspicion were afoot. As foreign steamers would leave London at about the time of high water, one plan would be to get down the river by a previous ebb tide, and lie by in some quiet spot until we could pull off to one. The time when one would be due, where we lay, whenever that might be, could be calculated pretty nearly, if we made inquiries beforehand. Herbert assented to all this, and we went out immediately after breakfast to pursue our investigations. We found that a steamer for Hamburg was likely to suit our purpose best, and we directed our thoughts chiefly to that vessel. But we noted down what other foreign steamers would leave London with the same tide, and we satisfied ourselves that we knew the build and colour of each. We then separated for a few hours, I to get at once such passports as were necessary, Herbert to see Startop at his lodgings. We both did what we had to do without any hindrance, and when we met again at 1 o'clock, reported it done. I, for my part, was prepared with passports. Herbert had seen Startop, and he was more than ready to join. Those two would pull a pair of oars, we settled, and I would steer. Our charge would be sitter, and keep quiet. As speed was not our object, we should make way enough. We arranged that Herbert should not come home to dinner before going to Mill Pond Bank that evening, that he should not go there at all tomorrow evening, Tuesday, that he should prepare Provis to come down to some stairs hard by the house on Wednesday when he saw us approach, and not sooner, that all the arrangements with him should be concluded that Monday night, and that he should be communicated with no more in any way until we took him on board. These precautions, well understood by both of us, I went home. On opening the outer door of our chambers with my key, I found a letter in the box, directed to me. A very dirty letter, though not ill-written. It had been delivered by hand, of course, since I left home, and its contents were these. "If you are not afraid to come to the old marshes tonight, or tomorrow night at 9, and to come to the little sluice-house by the lime-kiln, you had better come. If you want information regarding your Uncle Provis, you had much better come and tell no one and lose no time. You must come alone. Bring this with you." I had had load enough upon my mind before the receipt of this strange letter. What to do now I could not tell, and the worst was that I must decide quickly, or I should miss the afternoon coach, which would take me down in time for tonight. Tomorrow night I could not think of going, for it would be too close upon the time of the flight. And again, for anything I knew, the proffered information might have some important bearing on the flight itself. If I had had ample time for consideration, I believe I should still have gone. Having hardly any time for consideration, my watch showing me that the coach started within half an hour, I resolved to go. I should certainly not have gone, but for the reference of my Uncle Provis. That coming on Wemmick's letter and the morning's busy preparation turned the scale. It is so difficult to become clearly possessed of the contents of almost any letter in a violent hurry, that I had to read this mysterious epistle again, twice before its injunction to me to be secret got mechanically into my mind. Yielding to it, in the same mechanical kind of way, I left a note in pencil for Herbert, telling him that as I should be so soon going away, I knew not for how long, I had decided to hurry down and back to ascertain for myself how Miss Havisham was faring. I had then barely time to get my greatcoat, lock up the chambers, and make for the coach office by the short byways. If I had taken a hackney chariot and gone by the streets, I should have missed my aim. Going as I did, I caught the coach just as it came out of the yard. I was the only inside passenger, jolting away knee-deep in straw when I came to myself. For I really had not been myself since the receipt of the letter. It had so bewildered me, ensuing on the hurry of the morning. The morning hurry and flutter had been great. For long and anxiously as I had waited Wemmick, his hint had come like a surprise at last, and now I began to wonder at myself for being in the coach, and to doubt whether I had sufficient reason for being there, and to consider whether I should get out presently and go back, and to argue against ever heeding an anonymous communication, and in short, to pass through all these phases of contradiction and indecision to which I suppose very few hurried people are strangers. Still, the reference to Provis by name mastered everything. I reasoned, as I had reasoned already without knowing it, if that be reasoning, in any case any harm should befall him through my not going, how could I ever forgive myself? It was dark before we got down, and the journey seemed long and dreary to me, who could see little of it inside, and who could not go outside in my disabled state. Avoiding the Blue Boar, I put up at an inn of minor reputation down the town and ordered some dinner. While it was preparing, I went to Satis House and inquired for Miss Havisham. She was still very ill, though considered something better. My inn had once been a part of an ancient ecclesiastical house, and I dined in a little octagonal common room, like a font. As I was not able to cut my dinner, the old landlord with a shining bald head did it for me. This bringing us into conversation, he was so good as to entertain me with my own story, of course with the popular feature that Pumblechook was my earliest benefactor and the founder of my fortunes. "Do you know the young man?" said I.
"Know him?" repeated the landlord. "Ever since he was no art at all."
"Does he ever come back to this neighbourhood?"
"Aye, he comes back," said the landlord. "To his great friends now and again, and gives the cold shoulder to the man that made him."
"What man is that?"
"Him that I speak of," said the landlord. "Mr. Pumblechook."
"Is he ungrateful to no one else?"
No doubt he would be if he could, returned the landlord, but he can't. And why? Because Pumblechook done everything for him.
Does Pumblechook say so?
Say so? Replied the landlord. He ain't no call to say so.
But does he say so?
It would turn a man's blood to white wine vinegar to hear him tell of it, sir, said the landlord.
I thought, yet Joe, dear Joe, you never tell of it. Long-suffering and loving Joe, you never complain. Nor you, sweet-tempered Biddy.
Your appetite's been touched like by your accident,
said the landlord, glancing at the bandaged arm under my coat.
Try a tender a bit.
No, thank you, I replied, turning from the table to brood near the fire. I can eat no more. Please, take it away. I had never been struck at so keenly for my thanklessness to Joe as through the brazen impostor Pumblechook. The falser he, the truer Joe. The meaner he, the nobler Joe. My heart was deeply and most deservedly humbled as I mused over the fire for an hour or more. The striking of the clock aroused me, but not from my dejection or remorse, and I got up and had my coat fastened round my neck and went out. I had previously sought in my pockets for the letter that I might refer to it again, but I could not find it, and was uneasy to think that it must have dropped in the straw of the coach. I knew very well, however, that the appointed place was the little sluice-house by the lime kiln on the marshes, and the hour 9. Towards the marshes I now went straight, having no time to spare.
Chapter 53. It was a dark night, though the full moon rose as I left the enclosed lands and passed out upon the marshes. Beyond their dark line there was a ribbon of clear sky, hardly broad enough to hold the red large moon. In a few minutes she had ascended out of that clear field in among the piled mountains of cloud. There was a melancholy wind, and the marshes were very dismal. A stranger would have found them insupportable, and even to me they were so oppressive that I hesitated, half inclined to go back. But I knew them well, and could have found my way on a far darker night, and had no excuse for returning, being there. So having come there against my inclination, I went on against it. The direction that I took was not that in which my old home lay, nor that in which we had pursued the convicts. My back was turned towards the distant hulks as I walked on, and though I could see the old lights away on the spits of sand, I saw them over my shoulder. I knew the lime kiln as well as I knew the old battery, but they were miles apart, so that if a light had been burning at each point that night, there would have been a long strip of the blank horizon between the two bright specks. At first I had to shut some gates after me, and now and then to stand still while the cattle that were lying in the banked-up pathway arose and blundered down among the grass and reeds. But after a little while I seemed to have the whole flats to myself. It was another half-hour before I drew near to the kiln. The lime was burning with a sluggish, stifling smell, but the fires were made up and left, and no workmen were visible. Hard by was a small stone quarry. It lay directly in my way, and had been worked that day, as I saw by the tools and barrows that were lying about. Coming up again to the marsh level out of this excavation, for the rude path lay through it, I saw a light in the old sluice-house. I quickened my pace, and knocked at the door with my hand. Waiting for some reply, I looked about me, noticing how the sluice was abandoned and broken, and how the house, of wood with a tiled roof, would not be proof against the weather much longer, if it were so even now, and how the mud and ooze were coated with lime, and how the choking vapour of the kiln crept in a ghostly way towards me. Still, there was no answer, and I knocked again. No answer still, and I tried the latch. It rose under my hand, and the door yielded. Looking in, I saw a lighted candle on a table, a bench, and a mattress on a truckle bedstead. As there was a loft above, I called, "Is there anyone here?" But no voice answered. Then I looked at my watch, and finding that it was past 9, called again, "Is there anyone here?" There still being no answer, I went out at the door, irresolute what to do. It was beginning to rain fast.
Seeing nothing save what I had seen already, I turned back into the house and stood just within the shelter of the doorway, looking out into the night. While I was considering that someone must have been there lately and must soon be coming back, or the